Let me then first introduce myself. I'm John Watkins, and I teach communication skills at Ferris State College in Big Rapids, Michigan. In terms of the things that we were doing Tuesday, since this is part two, what am I doing here? Anyway, in terms of the things that we were doing Tuesday, I want to go back and review them. We've got just about half of you who are new, so I'm going to be fairly brief about it. But the approach I'm taking for these 2 days, actually these 3 days, that I'm dealing with this content, is that of Tom Gordon. And many of you apparently are already acquainted with parent effectiveness training or teacher effectiveness training. And he's even taken that model and turned it into, I think, medical effectiveness training. And anyway, he has developed a model that I think is really neat in terms of relating with one another, and particularly with the area of listening skills. As we were talking last time, I put a model, a fairly common model, up on the board, which is the idea of the sender-receiver model. And the one point that I wanted to make with that, if you'll recall, was that, not that my wife left me last night, but the fact that we have, as we're listening to somebody else, we really are listening to them in stereo. And we're listening at one level where we're concerned with the codes, the words, the facts that are involved in a presentation. But then there is another track there. And that other track is the one of feelings and relationship. And it turns out then that anytime we communicate, we have a strand of message going through that includes all three levels, the factual or the content level, then the feeling level. I kind of think of this as being the meaning level, and then the behavioral level. And we've all been in situations where somebody's behavior has been very different from the words that they've been saying, and we can tell that. And one of the things that we have to go for is a message that is unified in terms of all three of those levels. I started talking also about the idea of hidden messages. Anybody want to share what the hidden messages thing was all about? Anybody recall?
You're saying something, but you don't mean it.
All right, so sometimes, okay, yeah, there is a second level. It may not be that you're contradicting yourself there, but it may mean also that there is another message that is going along with the words that you're saying that people need to be detecting.
You say, my, how well you look today, and you know they don't.
Okay, all right, and certainly that is a part of it. Somebody else? Yes?
Well, you're putting that person down by what you're saying.
Okay.
You're elevating yourself.
All right. One of the things that is really interesting is a can you top this session? Because if you listen there, what's going on is you're telling about that really neat, exciting experience that happened to you. You're letting that other person know in a hidden sort of way that their experience was not as neat as yours was. So anyway, the idea of the hidden message was a point that we were talking about last time. And I mentioned that Gordon had come up with 12 roadblocks to communication. And they fell into three kinds of packages. And the first one had to do with solution messages. And when somebody else was hurting and they're sharing a problem with us, we often will give them a solution. Now let me mention here, for those who were here last time, how many of you have your responses to the statements I made? How many of you have those with you? Just a few, okay, so I'm not going to be able to rely on that. Okay, well last time I gave several statements and asked everybody to respond to those on paper. To find out what hidden messages there were in their responses. And they were all situations in which somebody else had a problem. And one of the things that we very frequently do then is to give people a solution to their problem. And the minute we do that, there's a hidden message in it. And what was the hidden message in the solution message? Anyone?
I'm superior.
Okay, I'm your superior. Or really what we're saying is, I'm brighter than you are. I can figure this out and you can't. And it puts us up at that point and puts them down. The first kind of solution message we were talking about was that one of ordering and commanding and directing. And this is one where we didn't talk about last time, but what happens anytime I give somebody an order or a command, I wind up taking what is supposed to be an equal relationship. You know, they're my equal, I'm their equal, and I imbalance it. by giving them the solution. And what was the hidden message of this one? Anybody?
You're the boss.
Superior.
Okay, yeah, I'm the superior or I'm the boss. Anytime we start giving somebody else a solution to their problem, or giving them an order, in this sense, giving them command, we're saying, I'm in charge here, I'm the boss. The second category we talked about was that of warning and threatening. And what was the hidden message of this? Okay, all right, I can see into your future. And what I prophesy is this. And one of the things that's sort of interesting about being the prophet, have you ever noticed how many times when we give somebody a warning or a threat, we are being a prophet of doom? We very seldom tell them, you know, hey, keep this up and you're going to be a great person. We very seldom do that. We let them know that if you don't do this, then some negative consequence is going to happen. And we wind up being the prophet. If you can only remember the hidden messages here, that will be a help. How about that third quality of moralizing and preaching? Okay, we call that one the preacher. And one of the things I didn't ask last time, I don't believe I did anyway, was what is a moral? If I'm moralizing, what is a moral? I'm sorry, I got several answers and I didn't understand any one.
Your standard.
Okay, all right, let's take that word standard. A moral is basically a standard of behavior, isn't it? And so when we moralize to somebody, what are we telling them?
I'm right.
They aren't up to our standard.
Exactly. That's the point I want to get to. We are saying, anytime we moralize to them, anytime we preach to them, we are saying to them, look, there's a standard here. And it's a standard of conduct. It's a generally accepted standard of conduct. And you are not living up to this standard. And since I know what the standard is, I just wanted to bring it to your attention. Okay. So that's basically the approach that we take with that third area. The area of teaching and using logic and giving facts, I suggested that we add to that the area of persuasion or persuading. And what then was the hidden message of this category?
The teacher.
Okay, that would be the role played by the teacher. And of course, that's always, as I said last time, very difficult for me. But one of the things you might be aware of is that anytime you take on that role, when they have a problem and you try to persuade them toward your solution, it suggests that you have a vested interest in the outcome of what they do, doesn't it? If you're persuading them to do something your way, it really suggests a vested interest on your part. And if you find yourself persuading somebody very strongly to do things your way, you might want to take a look at that very question. Do you have an interest in the way they solve their problem? Okay? And the final category of the solution messages is that one of advising and suggesting. And what was the hidden message here? Anybody?
Advisor.
Okay, it was simply the advisor. And one of the things I wanted to point out about this, I did not yesterday, is usually when somebody comes to us and they have had a problem for a period of time, or it's usually because they have had a problem for a period of time. They've ruminated, they've gone over it and over it and over it and over it in their minds, and they cannot come up with the answer. And so they come to us and they put us up by saying, hey, will you help me? And that makes us feel good. They put themselves down at the same time, and then we start giving them our advice. And do you notice what a quick fix we give them? Sure, you've been thinking about this problem all this period of time, you can't come up with the answer, and you come to John. And you say, I'm having this problem. And so the first piece of advice I give you, or the first suggestion I give you, is really a quick fix, isn't it? Now, I don't know all the details. I don't know all the ramifications. Maybe you didn't even share with me all the ramifications, but I can solve your problem like that. Doesn't that make me look bright? And doesn't that make you look stupid? Duh. Okay? So it winds up being a put down. So we have those as five categories then of solution messages. The next category we were talking about was that of put down messages. What was the hidden message of the put down? Anybody?
There's something wrong with you.
Okay, there's something wrong with you. Or another one was, I'm well and you're sick. Okay? Now, with that in mind, we talk in terms of judging, criticizing, disagreeing, and blaming. And what was the hidden message of that? You recall it? Anybody? Go with that. Remember the accuser? And what I wanted to share here is that usually the time that we wind up doing our ridiculing, doing our blaming, is after that other person has already blown it. Isn't it? They're hurting, they're feeling bad, something blew up in their face, and so what do? We come along and ridicule them for that bad situation. I was thinking of a situation where I happened to be in a car, I was in the back seat, and there was the driver up front and somebody sitting in on the other side, and we went around a left turn, and the driver had not anticipated the speed of another vehicle. And so we went around, and that other vehicle coming toward us just about got us. And here's the driver going, and what does the person in the front seat say? Boy, that was stupid. And here's the driver saying to himself already, oh, that was stupid. You know, and we just heap it on top. Okay, so we have the accuser. Let's go on with that next category of name-calling, stereotyping, and ridiculing. And what was the hidden message there?
Classifier.
I'm sorry? All right, the classifier. This is the person who classifies others. And usually, these are the people who can't understand why other people act like that. Do you know the type? I just can't understand why these people are this way, why they do that. Can you believe what they did? And they wind up classifying people, usually very negatively. What they're really saying with that is that they don't share my values. I have a different value system than they have, and they don't share mine, and they're not living up. And they get into a position where many times they reduce other people to one characteristic. You see what I mean? We do that, we think in terms of the classifications that are done in terms of stereotyping by race, or by sexist language, or whatever. And it reduces other people down to one qualification or one quality. It may be, or one characteristic. It may be their sex. It may be their race. It may be the way they do or do not comb their hair, or whatever. If they have more hair than I do to comb. Now, let's go on to that next category, that of interpreting, analyzing, and diagnosing. And what were we talking about here as the hidden message of it? All right, this is the analyst. And one thing the analyst does I didn't talk about last time, the analyst is one who very frequently will ascribe motives to other people's behavior. Now, I have done something up front. I did it because I wanted to do it. And somebody comes up to me and tells me, well, the only reason you did that was because. And so they ascribe motives to my behavior. It's kind of a situation of, I think that's probably explained as well. The example I was going to give won't fit. All right, final category that we talked about yesterday was that one of praising, agreeing, and giving positive evaluations. And let me show you, I didn't show this to you yesterday, the hidden message is the defender. And what the person is defending is, they're defending you. to yourself, in a way, as they are praising you. One example that I think really convinced me that praising was a put-down was with my daughter, who is, at age 7 was really into art, into drawing and so forth. And she would come out to the living room one evening, and she'd have this picture. She'd been in her room, she'd been drawing for quite a period of time, and she brought out this picture. And she said, John, now she calls me John because I am her stepdad, and she said, John, is this good? Well, what are you going to say to a 7-year-old under those circumstances? It could be the worst possible picture in the world, and what are you going to say? Oh, Lisa, that's good, that's good, that's great, that's wonderful. So she smiles and she goes off to her room. About 5-7 minutes later, she's back out. I've been reading. She's back out. I put down the magazine. She says, John, is this good? I say, oh, Lisa, that's very good. That's very good. That's wonderful. Isn't that what we do? She goes back to her room. 5 minutes later, she's out there again, and she's got a different picture, and is this good? And then it dawned on me, after she'd gone back to her room, what was I doing? I was blocking her communication by praising her. Because as soon as she came out and showed that to me, and I said, Lisa, that is good, what else was there for her to say? I'd given it, you know, total accolade. And so the next time she brought a picture out, I said, Lisa, you've really been working on this, haven't you? Yeah. And you had a lot of fun with that. Yeah, let me show you what I did. And she climbs up on the sofa beside me, and for the next 5 to 10 minutes, she's telling me about everything in that picture. By praising her, I had stopped her from saying anything more about it. And that was the first time it really dawned on me that praise of other people, when they're feeling great, stops them from sharing it. They can't say anything more about it. And I've done that with college students, too, where one of my fellows will be, you know, on the hockey team. We have... a pretty strong hockey team where we are, and a lot of them take the communication classes. And I've gone, I said, hey, I really enjoyed the game the other night. And the fellow said, did you see my goal? And I said, I sure did. That must have been a neat shot, neat feeling. He said, yeah, you know, that was the first one. And then he went on to tell me what a neat feeling that really was and how that had happened and how he planned the whole work, everything. But, you know, if I had said, great, 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 he couldn't have gone on that way. Okay? So, let's go on then, starting with some new ones. Continuing the put-downs, the idea of reassuring, sympathizing, and supporting. And one of the things that when we offer someone reassurance or sympathy is that we suggest to the other person many times that they might be overreacting. If we tell them, hey, it's going to get better, we suggest in a way that they may be overreacting to the situation they're in. But one of the things, just as an example of this, and maybe you can think back, you obviously many of you, our parents have been parents, and certainly you've had parents. I can remember just a few years ago when I was working on my doctorate, and I had my comprehensives coming up, and the comprehensives were going to cover, you know, several years of my training. And I was really nervous about them. They were requiring an awful lot of energy. And my mom called, or I called her, I don't know exactly how it worked. But she said, John, how are things going? And I said, well, Mom, I've really been sweating my comps. Well, John, you'll do well. Yeah, I know, Mom, but it's really been bothering me a lot. Well,
you worried like this about your master's comps. You did well then, you'll do well again. I know, Mom, but I mean, it's really hurting. I'm really concerned this time. These are pretty taking an awful lot of my time. Well, you've done difficult things before, and you can do it again. And here's all of this uplifting kind of stuff. And I finally said, Mom, I know all that. But I just want you to understand that I'm worried about it. That's all. Just understand that I'm worried. And that's all I wanted her to do. And so we wind up with her then being virtually the consoler. Anytime you tell somebody or I tell somebody that I understand how they feel, what are we doing?
Not letting in.
Exactly. We stop them right at that point, don't we? They cannot share anymore. Why? Because if I understand how they feel, what is there left to share? You see? If you tell that to me, I have to assume that you've been there. One of the neat things about knowing about the roadblocks here is that it empowers you to jump over somebody else's roadblocks when they're blocking you, when you're sharing. I used to have an office mate in Phoenix who was the neatest woman. And she was one person I knew I could trust, I could go to, and share something that was bothering me, something that was going on in my family or whatever. And her response, unfortunately, often was to say, John, I know where you're coming from. We had the same problem with our kids. And I'd have to say, wait a moment, Sarah Gale. No, you didn't have the same problem. This is a little bit different, I'm sure. And I would have to jump over this roadblock that I could rely that she was going to give to me. That we've been there before. I know how it is. I understand. Boy, have I been there. And many times when we use those expressions of, boy, I understand, we want to convince the other person, don't we, that we understand. So what do? We take over the sharing and say, let me tell you about my experience. And that winds up putting us up because we solved our experience and putting them down. Last category of the put-down messages is that of probing, questioning, and interrogating, for those of you who are keeping notes. If you think back to what you wrote yesterday, those of you who are putting down your responses, how many of you can think back to a number of questions you asked? Let me ask for more information. Why do you ask questions of somebody else when they have a problem? They come to you. Why do you ask questions?
Pardon? Find out.
Find out more. Get more information. Why do you want more information?
So you can help them.
So you can help them. How are you going to help them?
Solve.
By solving their problem for them. That's right.
Can't you get at the feelings behind it this way?
If you're saying, well, how are you feeling, that may be. You know, how do you feel about that? Certainly that opens the door to talk about that. But usually what happens is that we don't ask for how do you feel about that. What we ask for are the factual details of the situation. And we want those so we can solve their problem for them. But what did we conclude yesterday about advising and giving suggestions and so forth?
Why don't you just listen? People want you.
Great, absolutely right. That becomes ultimately the bottom line. Why don't we just listen and keep our mouths shut? But we wind up then asking those kinds of questions so that we can solve their problem for them. Second thing is here that when we start, does somebody have a problem that they could share just very briefly? I know it's warm in here. Maybe somebody would like to tell me how warm they are. Anybody have something they'll share with me? Just very briefly. What is your problem, ma'am?
I have the problem after listening to you of you saying the problem is mine, for instance. The solution also is mine.
Okay.
So I should do that to others. The problem is yours, the solution is yours. I'll listen, but that's all.
Okay, well, why is that posing a problem for you?
I just wanted to tell you that.
Yeah, but why do you want to tell me?
Because I don't really have that problem.
Well, why did you share it in the first place then?
She just likes to talk.
Just to make things a little more emphatic.
Okay, do you see what's been happening here?
Questions.
Yeah, I was going ahead with my questions, my interrogation. I don't know if you felt defensive along the way, but that would not be at all unusual. But beyond that, here she is. She has a problem. And she wants to go from point A over to point B. You know, somewhere out there, she's got a solution to her problem. But I come along, and I say, what's your problem? She tells me a little bit. I start asking questions. And so the first time I ask her a question, what does that do? It takes her off track, doesn't it? She's got to deal with my question. So then I ask another question in response to that, and I take her further off track. And then I ask another question, and I take her further off track. Until ultimately, she is way off track, and we part, and I'm thinking, my boy, wasn't I helpful to her? And she's leaving saying, gosh, I wish somebody would listen to me. So that becomes one of the major problems with asking questions, is that we take control and take them off track, and we take them where we want them to go, rather than let them go where they want to go. Okay, so we wind up then with those six put down messages. The last, oh yes, question.
When you're trying to share, someone trying to share with you.
Yes.
It always seemed like questions would lead them into telling you more or getting it out of them, but you say not.
Okay, yeah, I well, certainly you are getting often factual content, but in terms of where what their feeling dimension is like, they're not being able to share that. And the suggestion then is that maybe if you give me enough information, I can solve your problem for you, you know, which is the one that we were dealing with earlier. So anyway, we wind up then with our questions and so forth being lawyer. Last category, overall category, is that of avoidance messages. And we do wind up doing a lot of avoiding of other people who are hurting. And we do it in several different ways. The first, well, let me put simply Gordon's list up there. That of withdrawing or distracting, of being sarcastic, so forth. Now the overall hidden message that goes along with the avoidance messages is a message that it's not safe for me to be around you. It's not safe to be around you, or to be around you with your problem. Anyway, you're unsafe to be around. And so as a result, I'm going to avoid. Now, I may avoid in several different ways. One of them is I may desert you. I may go AWOL. And I think that AWOL, I think back to a conversation I had with my brother probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And he had mentioned that things were not going overly well with him and his wife. And he went on to say that whenever they had a problem, he had a good solution to it. And his good solution was that he would go for a walk. Because if his wife was angry, well, he didn't want to get a rhubarb going, and so he'd go for a walk. The interesting thing was that whenever he was angry with her, rather than get a rhubarb going, he would go for a walk. Now, what was he telling her each of those times?
I want none.
Pardon?
I want none.
I want none of it. And he was saying basically, it is not safe for me to be around you in a tense situation. It just is not safe. And so obviously that puts her down. But what does it? What else does it do? It assures that whatever the source of the tension is, it is never going to be resolved because we're walking out on it all the time. Okay? And the outcome, I can say in that instance, I'm not saying this is always the outcome, but it didn't surprise me when a few years later they wound up divorcing. Why not? They've never worked out. They never developed that level of trust that says, I can be angry with you and share my anger and share what's bothering and trust you to accept it. And at the same time, I can allow you the same freedom to share with me and to have you trust me to accept your anger and your resentment. But anyway, we wind up many times walking out on tense situations. We never get them resolved that way. And the relationships dissolve. Second one that I come across every once in a while is that one of the joker. And this is usually, where I come across this is usually at a business gathering of some sort. And there is usually one fellow that I refer to as being the glad hand type. Oh, he's so glad to see you, and he's a hail fellow well met. And he cannot wait to get up and talk with me afterward about saying, well, don't you think it's best that when things are starting to get tense, if you just crack a joke, then all the tension subsides and then you can get down to the business again. And he describes this as being his approach. And everybody loves him because they can rely on him when things get tough, that he'll crack a joke and then everything will be fine. Do you know that type of person? How many of you do? How many of you seen that person in operation? Okay, what does that assure? It guarantees that while people are laughing, you know, and there may be a sense of relief, or so it seems, it guarantees that the source of the problem is going to be lying there and festering. It never does get worked out because this person's been avoided. Okay. The last one here is the area of the switchman. I have a couple examples I'd like to give you on this one. You may be able to identify. During the time I was teaching at Phoenix College, one of my students, who was the daughter of a mortician, shared with me something that had just happened a few nights before, where her dad had found out about it because of his career. We had a man in Phoenix who, in his early 70s, woke up one morning to find his wife, her body, lying in bed beside him. She had died during the night. And for the next 3 nights, this fellow slept on the sofa and left his wife's body in the bed. Now, I want you to conjecture with me about that gentleman's life. And I want you to go back in time to the point where he may have been maybe in the second grade, maybe in the third grade. And he comes home from school, sits down at the dinner table, and he says to mom and dad, Joey's dad, well, Joey wasn't in school today, his dad was killed in an auto accident last night. What's it like to die? And mom or dad say, well, that's really not something to talk about at the dinner table, son. We'll talk about that later. Or a little bit, maybe days, weeks, months later, mom hears whimpering in the bedroom, his bedroom, late at night. And she goes in and she says, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" And he says, "I'm scared." "What are you afraid of?" "I'm afraid I'm going to die in my sleep." "Why?" "Because I was just noticing that my mouth is open and I'm breathing. And I'm afraid that if I go to sleep, maybe my mouth will close and I won't be able to breathe and I'll die in my sleep." And what does Mother say as he says, "What's it like to die again?" Mother says, "Don't you worry about that. God has taken care of that. You're not going to die for a long, long time." And how many times in this man's life was death as a topic switched to something more pleasant and neater to talk about? I think one of the neatest experiences I had was that I was asked to go from Phoenix to Texas to do some consulting in a school district. They were having a number of consultants in from all over the country for this very small district in Texas, very wealthy district. And I was in there to talk about listening and teaching listening and so forth. And I learned that this courageous school district, as small as it was, had another consultant in teaching the teachers to teach about death and dying to elementary school kids. And I thought how absolutely neat, and I wanted to go into my own group and say, "People, I'm canceling today because I want you to go in there and listen to that. That's what really needs to be shared." One other topic that I found really necessary because of the switchment that I found necessary to deal with in terms of my college kids is one, the best illustration of it is this. When we were living in Phoenix, my dad and my mom came down to visit us. My dad went through some tests down there. And the doctor called my mother and me in and said that he, sir, was wondering how much to share with my dad and so forth, but he would guess that my dad only had about 6 months to live because of some symptoms and so forth that he was showing in the tests. And I, the next day, or no, that evening, I'm sorry, went down to my office and I called my brother in Washington. And I, my gosh, I'm in Washington now. Wonderful. Anyway, I called my brother and I told him what had happened. I said, "We just got the test back from Dad, and the doctor says that he probably has about 6 months to live." And my brother made the opening comment. He's 8 years older than I, and his opening words were that it's the beginning of the end. And then he started to cry. And I could hear him sob, and he'd go, and he'd start to speak. And he couldn't speak, and he'd sob again. And he'd start to speak, and he'd sob again. And I finally said, "Bob, put the phone down on your lap and just cry, because I'll be here when you pick it up again." And so that's what he did, and I could hear him just bawling for 4 or 5 minutes there. And finally he picked up that phone again, and his opening words to me were, "John, I'm sorry I lost control." And my response to him was, "Bob, if you can't cry at a time like this, for God's sake, when can you cry?" And I share that with my classes, and I guess I'm sort of sharing it here too. Because I've found that it has been so necessary for me in a college classroom to give all my macho jocks permission to cry. Because all of their lives, they have been distracted from that very human characteristic and that human way of dealing with difficult problems. So, And I have to let them know that, yes, I cry. And I want them to know that some of the most macho fellows are the ones who are sitting in my office sharing something very deep, very personal, and crying. And they're macho because they've gone in the face of what convention is asking them to do. And that has been neat. Now, these, all of these then, the 12 that I've given you, are what Gordon refers to as being the dirty dozen. And I'm wondering how many of you are having that sense of, is there anything that I can say? How many have had that as a sort of feeling? Okay, all right. Let me say, yes, there are. So some neat things that you can do and some neat things that you can say. And the one thing I think of anything that I want to stress right now is that there is nothing wrong with any of these responses to other people, as long as they are not experiencing at the time strong feeling. In other words, let's go back to that one of praising. If you've seen me around here in terms of with my son, you will have found me praising him. Now, I am not praising him at times when he's having strong feeling of feeling great. I want to hear those great things that he's done and he's feeling excited about. And I'm not praising him when he's feeling down and bad. I'm praising him at times when it's a normal, neat kind of period in the day, and I'm letting him know how neat I think he is. So I'm going to praise. My family, if we were to go back here a few slides here, will notice, or if you were to ask them, they would let you know that I have some, I think it's neat sarcasm. They don't. And even the area of humoring or using humor, they will tell you that it is rough having a dad or a husband who uses the kind of puns that I do. So under normal circumstances, these are all fine. It's just when there is strong feeling that you don't use them. At that point, you use some new tools. And the new tools that you'll be using, hopefully, are going to be those I will share tomorrow. That's really terrible. That's really terrible. But what I have found, one of the things, I frequently go out and do this presentation with people who are hospice volunteers. How many of you are acquainted with hospice? Okay, a good many of you are. Those of you who are not acquainted with it, I frequently define it very poorly or describe it very poorly. But it is a program, it's an alternative to hospitals, if you will, that is intended for people who are in their final 6 months or less of life. And it's an alternative that offers respect and dignity in the dying period of time. And it was interesting to me that Elmer had the assistance of a hospice program during the time that his wife was dying. And that made I was glad to hear that. But anyway, so I am going to those people and sharing this as an overall presentation. And one of the most frustrating things that they share with me is that why is it that I use one evening to talk about the things they shouldn't do, and they have to wait a whole week to find out about the things that they should. You only have to wait one day. So maybe I should pause and ask for any questions that you may have, or frustrations you may feel, or whatever. Anyone?
Well, I was going to, before you mentioned hospice, I was going to make the observation that you can give permission to cry, but you can also give permission to die.
Yes.
Apparently that's something you're talking about, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, you bet. Right. Yes.
How sensitive do you have to be in the area of strong feelings? Is that a critical line, or? And there are some people that are just not real sensitive at sensing strong feelings, and they may be using a sarcastic comment back or a praise when they shouldn't be.
I don't know if I would agree with you here in terms of their sensitivity. I think there are people who are more resistant to responding to strong feeling than people who are sensitive to them. I think we all know when the feeling level is getting perhaps uncomfortable. And that's often when the humoring will come out as a quick response to shut that off. And so I think that comes in. Secondly, if there is a question about that level of feeling, there is what we'll be talking about as sort of an active listening response or a response at that feeling level. And it's a possibility to go with that, and if we don't get an appropriate reply from them, we may have misjudged the situation. And I've done that. I mean, I have misjudged situations before. So, yeah, maybe if that deals with your question. Okay, all right. Anybody else? Any other observations, questions? Yes.
I think too, I'm anticipating what will come with the new tools a little bit, but we should not feel guilty from using these kinds of things sometimes, because sometimes you just don't have the time to pursue it further, or you know, there are a lot of reasons sometimes for making the statements or the questions or whatever we do just quickly.
In other words,
and I guess we can't do it right all the time.
That's right. And there's another thing. I'm so glad you used the terminology you did there too, because it cued one thing I did want to share that I have not shared in this. It fits very well with what you're saying. In dealing with this kind of content, when we're learning about things that we've been doing habitually, these have been habitual responses for all of us. We learned them from our parents, and now we're sort of passing them on. And one of the things that happens initially when we learn about the Dirty Dozen here is that we feel guilty. Because we can think back probably within the last 24 hours to the time when somebody was sharing something and we did one of these things. And we're feeling guilty about that. Now, my own view has been that if I have done my best with the information I had and I found out later on there was a better way of doing it, then I choose not to feel guilty about having done it the other way. But if you want to feel guilty, please go ahead and do so. Now, once you know that, though, you are at one level. Now, the next level, as we start talking about new skills or new tools, there's a pretty good chance you're going to start feeling phony as you try to use these. Because we wind up saying, I've never done it this way before. And just about the time we're feeling the phoniest, somebody is going to say to us, you talk funny. And that will really make us feel phony. Okay? The next level we will hit if we keep going with it is one where we're feeling skillful. And what that means to me is exactly what it says, full of skill. Where we'll be very much aware of the skills that we have, and we may be able to say to ourselves, boy, I'm doing a good job at this. But the final level we hit is going to be one where we have now adopted the new skills so well into our style that it would be as hard to change those as it would be to change from doing the Dirty Dozen right now. Okay, so I wanted to share that information with you. Anybody else? I guess we're getting closer to time. Yes?
Isn't it possible sometimes to use one of those Dirty Dozen as an opener and then use the new tool, especially in a situation where you're with someone who knows you very well? I'm thinking of humor or even, you know, a criticism that kind of cuts a little bit.
All right, let me say, I shared yesterday that I had some differences with Tom Gordon and from my own approach, and so I don't want you to think of this as being totally Gordon's material. Because I do have some differences, and one of the differences comes in the fact that once in a while it becomes almost appropriate to confront somebody with their behavior. And Gordon would deny that. I'm sure he would. But from just other training that I have had, I see where it is appropriate to confront. Because sometimes people have a problem and they don't even recognize that they have the problem, and they would recognize it on confrontation. And then you can listen that out. So, yes?
When I really try to practice this, it seems to be very intense to lean forward, and my mind is rolling and I'm trying to analyze every word and think, what is it I say here and here? With enough practice, does that intenseness ever decrease? Because, you know, I couldn't listen to someone for 8 hours a day.
You mean if they are intense? You
no, mean, I'm the one that's intense because I'm trying to put into practice everything I've learned about listening.
Could I offer a different term from intenseness or intensity to one of earnestness? I hope the earnestness would never change. I don't know if that would be solving your problem with that. Hopefully, as you were listening to them, their own intensity would subside somewhat.
Yeah. But over time, with that person and other people, will his skills develop so that he becomes more natural and he's not working so hard?
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, they would become more integrated. I think what you're probably describing here is a situation where you're feeling skillful rather than integrated. You're aware of the skills that you're using right now.
Yeah.
And there will become a time where you'll just start doing very naturally. And it's just sort of a way of living, or a way of responding. I guess a number of you have met my son by this point. He is not a non-vocal child. Those of you who have met him know that. And as we were coming out here, we were coming up the coast and we got to Seattle, and my brother took us out on the cruise of the San Juans. And that was such a neat experience. But we were out probably about half a day, and my son had been right up on the bow. And there was a couple there, man and woman, and just the three of them out in the bow for quite a period of time. And I finally went out just to check on him and see how things were going. And I got out there, and this gentleman said, your son's been telling me everything there is to know about you. And I said, well, that doesn't surprise me. He said, he tells me you teach listening. And I said, yes. And he said, what would you say is prerequisite to being able to listen? And boy, if that didn't put me on the spot right there. And I came up with an answer that I've since been glad I came up with, because I think it's very true. The one thing that is prerequisite to being able to listen to another person is to be willing to be changed. Because you cannot listen to somebody else wholeheartedly without risking coming out of that relationship different than you were when you went into it. And I think that probably is one of the biggest reasons why people don't listen, is that we don't want to be any different than we are. And I've heard listening described as being the one area in which we can describe ourselves as being totally selfless. Because if you are listening to somebody else, you are giving over everything that you are, everything that you have, to them. And I think that's really a neat gift to be given. I've heard it described as the most Christian thing you can do. That's a good point to stop. There's a question.
Well, now, so I want to be able to be here tomorrow. We're leaving tomorrow. Do you have a tape on the new tools?
There will be.
How about just
putting
it out
there? Okay. Okay. Well, let me just very quickly do that. That is unfair of me because there are. Let me just put it up here very quickly. We'll be talking about those four tools and how to use them effectively. They may not look new, but for most of us, they are in this situation. So, have a neat day.